The last investigator I met with was Dr. Loretta Nastupil from MD Anderson Cancer Center. And to begin, she presented a patient from her practice.
So I had a 62-year-old male who was essentially primary refractory. He was advanced stage at presentation with bulky disease with a greater than 10 centimeter intra-abdominal node. It was a non-germinal center. And in the midst of R-CHOP, he had an interim scan that looked like he was responding, but at the completion of 6 cycles of R-CHOP, he still had refractory disease. And we could critique what was done at that point, but he essentially underwent consolidative radiation therapy. And within the time period of completing his radiation, he had progression outside of the radiation field. At that time, he went on to receive RGDP, which is based on a publication that's come out in the last few years, primarily from the Canadians, looking at RGDP versus RDAP, which appears to be equivalent in terms of efficacy, but slightly better tolerated, and it might be more appealing as an outpatient regimen. Unfortunately, he was still refractory to his first-line salvage therapy. At that point, he was initiated on RICE, and there is data that is coming out of the CORAL study looking at folks who fail their first salvage and what is the response to second salvage. And generally speaking, when patients are primary refractory, their outcomes are quite poor. So in general, their overall survival is expected to be at best 20%. Of those who fail second line, again, very, very poor outcomes. But if you look at that paper closely, you might be able to salvage as many as 40% of patients who still fail their first salvage therapy. You're not necessarily the primary refractory. So I don't think it's unreasonable to try a third-line chemotherapy, but our optimism at that point of that working was quite low. He was then initiated on lenalidomide and rituximab. This is a gentleman that was not close to Houston, so he lived approximately 8 hours away, and participating on a clinical trial was not entirely feasible. So we treated him with lenalidomide and rituximab and actually had quite good outcome. He did not achieve a partial response, but he did have reduction in tumor volume. But what was so striking is that he had been rapidly progressing in the setting of chemotherapy, but in the setting of lenalidomide, we actually gained disease control and actually had some improvement in tumor volume, though again, not more than 50% to classify him as a partial response. At that point, we then were successfully able to enroll him on a clinical trial, which it's amazing what patients will do whenever they are faced with essentially refractory disease. But we were actually successfully able to treat him with a CAR T-cell on protocol, achieving his first complete response, which has been durable. But what I wanted to highlight in this case is that there are clearly targets in the non-germinal center large cell lymphoma, which appear quite appealing, particularly for patients who are not chemosensitive and not your candidate for high-dose therapy autologous stem cell transplant. It also suggests that if you can identify a subset of patients that respond to immune therapy, a more intensive or specific immune therapy approach might be quite appealing. So I generally think of lenalidomide as having two aspects. One, you're targeting the non-germinal, the B-cell receptor signaling pathway, and you're also augmenting the innate immune system by enhancing NK and T-cells. So I generally will use this approach, particularly in my non-germinal center large cell lymphomas who are not trial candidates or not candidates for high-dose therapy and autologous stem cell transplant.
With or without rituximab?
That's a great question. So if you look at the studies without rituximab, the response was only about 20%. When you add rituximab, particularly in phase 2 studies, you get higher response, but it's much more durable as well. So there are clearly subsets of patients that respond well. At least that's what we've learned from our phase 2 studies. But about 30% of patients will respond and do so for more than 6 months.
How long has it been since this patient got the CAR T therapy?
So he underwent CAR T cell therapy in December of 2015.
So that's like 9 or 10 months.
Correct.
He's in CR.
Correct.
Wow, what a story. I want to ask you about that, but just to pick up on a couple of the other things first, it's interesting that he benefited from the lenalidomide and then afterwards benefited from CAR T therapy. Do you think there potentially could be any connection or even something related to sequencing?
I think you highlight some really good questions that we don't currently know the answer to. We generally do like to see some sense of response before I will take patients to CAR T. And what I mean by that, if I can debulk them some, I generally think that they will have a better outcome. Now, this has not been described in prospective studies, but we do know that the CAR Ts are currently associated with pretty high toxicity. And so if we can have some idea that they're going to respond to an immune therapy approach with something such as lenalidomide, and if I can reduce the proliferative rate prior to proceeding with CAR T, I'm much more optimistic optimistic about the outcomes in those patients. Now, generally speaking, we've seen only small case series that have been presented at meetings in terms of the CAR T efficacy, but it does appear to be quite high. But there are some patients that do fail, and we're trying to tease out who those are. Does it have to do with the conditioning regimens? Does it have to do with the loss of CD19 expression? Does it have to do with just the limited efficacy with the CAR Ts themselves? So there are many questions that are still being teased out with the CAR T, but we do know that the toxicity is not something that should be minimized, and it should be managed with, again, a multidisciplinary approach in centers where you have access to ICU care, because these patients can get quite sick in a very short period of time. So my general opinion is that it's more toxic than an auto transplant, but it might be applicable in a patient who has chemo-refractory disease who's not a candidate for auto, and you're not going to get that patient to an allotransplant.
And you're kind of talking about the cytokine release syndrome that's seen with CAR T therapy.
Correct. So we've seen cytokine release syndrome. We've also seen some neurotoxicity. One study was recently put on hold due to a couple patients passing away as a result of cerebral edema. So we've seen some neurotoxicity at our site with some of the other CAR T agents. So seizure activity is not infrequent. Confusion, change in the mini mental status exam is not infrequent. Generally, these have all been reversible. But the cerebral edema is what I think we worry the most about.
Can you kind of walk us through what happens when a patient gets CAR T therapy, for example, this patient, and how this patient specifically tolerated it?
So generally speaking, first we have to collect their CAR Ts. And so patients are undergoing apheresis, which is not the most complex. But again, at our center, it's generally a multidisciplinary approach where we have to have collaboration with our transplant and apheresis center. Once the CAR Ts are sent off, they're usually central manufacturing sites, again, depending on the company or the sponsor of the study. And the turnaround time in terms of when those CAR Ts are actually available to infuse into the patient is anywhere from 2 to 5 weeks. And if you have a highly proliferative tumor, that can be a very challenging time period to manage these folks so that they don't get into significant trouble before you can actually treat them. Once you know the CAR Ts are available, then you generally will give them T-cell depleting therapy, and that's been slightly different across the studies. That usually will go on from anywhere from 2 to 5 days of outpatient chemotherapy, and then they're admitted to the hospital. They receive their CAR Ts. Generally speaking, the most challenging aspect is getting them to the T-cell infusion without them either progressing rapidly or becoming too ill to participate in the study. Once they're admitted to the hospital, within a few hours after the T-cell infusion, it's not uncommon to see the cytokine release syndrome start. It seems to peak around day 4 to 7. And then it generally gets better from that time point forward. The neurotoxicity is a little bit less predictable, or at least in my experience. And so the onset can be anywhere from 4 days in to last sometimes. So this particular patient had significant neurotoxicity.
Really? What happened?
So all of the patients we've seen so far have had fever. So he had fever. And in the midst of fever, we were looking into source of infection. He was having difficulty with word finding. He was having difficulty with orientation. And it progressed to the point where he was essentially somnolent. He had no seizure activity, but he was prophylaxed with Keppra and monitored very closely from our neurology colleagues.
What did his brain look like on MRI?
So no abnormalities have been seen on MRI, which is quite striking. Even in patients that have severe neurotoxicity, we've not identified any changes in the brain MRI. We have picked up some patients that have subclinical seizure activity, and we've had patients that have had status epilepticus. So it's big spectrum there. We're generally thinking about prophylaxing every patient with Keppra. The cytokine release syndrome, though, not to minimize that concern, generally speaking, I think we're successful at identifying patients that become hemodynamically unstable. We can manage them appropriately. I think the neurotoxicity is a little bit more challenging, in my opinion, because it's more unpredictable and it's a little bit harder to tease out what is the cause. Is it seizure activity? Is it just global brain dysfunction? We don't know if it's the CAR Ts that are compromising the blood-brain barrier and causing cytokine release within the brain, or if it's something else. So those are questions that are still being teased out. But this particular patient, so he improved in terms of alertness. So he was alert, he was awake, but he could not use his cell phone or remote control for approximately 3 months.
3 months. Did you ever give him corticosteroids?
He did not have corticosteroids because he was not seizing. So we have grading that will determine when we give TOCI or when we give steroids. And even though it was changed from his baseline, it wasn't severe enough to warrant those things. Now, he did get Keppra, and he was on a very long taper of Keppra, but he didn't receive steroids, and he never received tocilizumab.
So you say it really took almost 3 months for the neurologic symptoms to go away.
Correct.
Interesting. What an amazing case. Mm-hmm. Can you sort of provide a little bit of an overview of what we know about the efficacy of CAR T therapy right now in lymphomas, including diffuse large B-cell?
Right. So the efficacy appears to be quite high. So in general, we're thinking about something that is truly worth pursuing. We're looking for efficacy with a response rate over 30% in relapsed large cell lymphoma. We're seeing efficacy above 60%, and we're also seeing complete response rates above 50%, which is quite striking. So this is sort of an all or none type of approach where we're really shooting for a complete response, and we do believe those complete responses to be durable. Where we've seen problems is, so patients have their first response assessment generally on study at day 30, which is quite early. There have been a few patients that have had a partial response that then convert to a complete response, but probably more likely those who have a partial response will ultimately end up progressing. So that's your first glimpse of how effective this will be. Now, again, there are differences in terms of the CAR Ts, in terms of their characteristics in regards to their activating signals. There are also differences in terms of how we infuse the CAR Ts that are being looked into. There are newer generations of CAR Ts where you can dial down the toxicity with either an off signal or a sleeper cell that you can inactivate the CAR Ts. So there are lots of different technologies that are currently being explored, but the efficacy appears to be quite high. I think what we're trying to work out is the toxicity and whether or not this will be something that can be done at many centers across the United States, because it's still requiring a high level of care and essentially 24-hour supervision of these patients, which is not something that's entirely feasible at every community hospital.
Usually for how long is intensive support like that required?
It's a little bit unpredictable. So on average, it's anywhere from 4 to 7 days where the acuity can be quite high. But again, some of the neurotoxicity, though not requiring high level of care such as ICU care, but can actually be prolonged up to 30 days.
I guess the other issue kind of seems like the actual delivery, the obtaining CAR T cells. And I've heard the term off-the-shelf CAR T cells. Right. Is that a reality? And what is it?
I think that's a great question, and that's something that's being clearly looked into. The manufacturing has been a challenge, particularly for the highly aggressive lymphomas. So a lot of the manufacturing is happening at central sites. And again, we're at the mercy of when those cells are available, which can be anywhere from 2 to 5 weeks. The off-the-shelf is where essentially you identify an antigen where you have a T cell sitting on a shelf, meaning someone else's T cell, that will bind and effectively eliminate that antigen. The Baylor folks across the street from us in Houston have probably done most of that work where they've been very successful. So there was an ASH presentation last year from Dr. Helen Heslop and her group looking at essentially off-the-shelf CAR Ts with very high response rates. I think that's probably much more feasible if we start expanding this more broad stroke to more patients. But I also think that the toxicity still needs to be taken into consideration, and the efficacy in terms of duration of response is still an unanswered question. But that appears quite appealing.
Obviously, there are a number of cancers where we've heard success stories, including ALL. I'm not exactly sure what the FDA approval status is on any of these approaches. Is it likely or possible that, you know, one of these therapies are going to be approved in the near future, and in what disease?
So I think that's a great question. I think the acute leukemias are much further along than the lymphomas are, but we are accumulating quite a bit of data with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And we've completed a study that we expect will be before the FDA in the spring of 2017. None of these are currently FDA approved, but we are looking at the toxicity very, very closely. There are a number of pharmaceutical companies that are pursuing this outside of institution-developed CAR Ts, and there are plenty of centers across the United States that are developing their own version of CAR T, including MD Anderson. So I think that these things are clearly in the pipeline. I don't think any of them will be FDA approved in the near future, at least not for lymphoma, but I don't think it's too far off either. And really identifying the toxicity and management is where most of the interest is right now.
Although I have to say, I mean, when you're talking about, you know, particularly like this case, primary refractory diffuse large B-cells, already gotten several therapies, and then you hear stories like this, you know, you kind of wonder why it isn't available like now.
I completely agree. And so I have a handful of patients that I know they would be dead now if they did not have access to this therapy. And so I do think that this is something that will continue to be investigated. It will continue to evolve. And if we can dial down the toxicity while maintaining the efficacy, this is really exciting.
So we wanted your take on some of the new agents that sort of are entering this space in general. One, there was a paper earlier this year in the New England Journal, very prominent study, John Bird, et cetera, on another BTK inhibitor. And I think there are a bunch of them, but this one was acalabrutinib. Any thoughts about that paper, what they saw, and sort of indirectly how it seems to compare to ibrutinib?
Right. So I think one of the primary questions with ibrutinib is we know that there are some off-target effects, that it's not purely selective for inhibiting BTK. And what is the impact of those off-target effects? We know it probably adds to some of the toxicity, including the TEC and the platelet aggregation, potentially EGFR and rash and diarrhea. So I think one of the sort of interests in pursuing more selective agents, such as acalabrutinib, is what is the impact on efficacy if you can dial down some of the toxicity? And that's the primary question with this agent. They tested it in patients with relapsed CLL, and we know that ibrutinib fares quite well in relapsed CLL in terms of very high response rates, and they essentially showed that the overall response rate was quite high, 95%. They had about 30% of patients who had 17P, and 100% of those patients responded. Now, most of the responses are going to be a partial response or partial response with persistent leukocytosis, but in patients with relapsed CLL, is that a failure? I don't think so in my mind. If you can have adequate disease control for long periods of time. What they demonstrated, as opposed to some of the other previous BTK inhibitors, that the selectivity did not impact the efficacy. And I think that was really one of the primary questions. If you dial down some of these off-target effects, are you going to lose the efficacy? And at least in CLL, that does not appear to be the case.
I meant to ask you before, in terms of acalabrutinib, what's known in terms of bleeding in acalabrutinib, and is the thinking that maybe it would be maybe equally effective, but say less toxic or less bleeding?
Yes, it's a great question that we're learning more about as time goes on, but essentially, acalabrutinib does not impact TEC, and we think that that is the reason why ibrutinib impacts platelet aggregation. So we do know from the New England Journal paper that there was no major bleeding events. What we don't know is over time will that story change. We do know that acalabrutinib appears to be more potent, and so maybe you can intensify the dosing because you're seeing less in the way of side effects, and is that why they had very high response rates in the 17P? Is that going to impact the risk of transformation? We don't know the answer to those questions, but I think that is clearly an interesting observation that if you don't hit those off-target, particularly TEC inhibitors, you might see less in the way of toxicity, particularly with bleeding. Now, was at ASCO this year an abstract that looked at acalabrutinib in combination with the PD-1 antibody in pancreatic cancer, and there was one patient who had major bleeding. Now, the question was, did the patient have major bleeding because they had pancreatic cancer, and that was a local extension, or had it any impact in the setting of acalabrutinib? And that's now a question that's being asked. So at the European Hematology meeting this past year, there was a poster looking at the impact on platelet function and bleeding using several agents, including acalabrutinib and ibrutinib. Essentially, what they showed is it's probably dose-dependent, meaning at much higher doses of acalabrutinib, you might see some impact on platelets, but is that concentrations that we're seeing in patients? And we don't know the answer to that.
Did you say acalabrutinib and a PD-1 antibody?
Yes, in pancreatic cancer.
In pancreatic cancer, acalabrutinib and PD-1 antibody. Would have never guessed that one.
Yeah, so that to me is a very interesting study. So there's been a study looking at ibrutinib in combination with nivolumab across different cancers. And with that, we know that the off-target impact on ITK and maybe some of the macrophages may actually enhance the microenvironment in the immune therapy approach. What I don't know is if you have acalabrutinib, which the story is that it's much more targeted, and then you combine it with an immune therapy agent, what is going to be the outcome in terms of efficacy? The fact they're testing it in solid tumors appears quite interesting, but I do think that now the spotlight's going to be on efficacy.
Let's finish out talking about your 67-year-old man with follicular lymphoma.
Yeah, so follicular lymphoma is actually my area of interest, and we do see these cases all the time. And as I go around and talk to community oncologists, I think the primary question that comes up is how do we manage these folks over time, and what is the preferred frontline, second line, third line approach? And also, what do these patients ultimately die from? Is it from transformation? Is it from other comorbid conditions? And I think these are the primary questions. If we look at the Stanford data that came out in the last few years, it looks like, at least for the grade 1-2 patients, their median outcome is somewhere around 18 plus years. So I generally think of follicular lymphoma as being a marathon, but there are probably two groups of patients, those that are refractory to therapy, even in the absence of transformation, or those that progress early and we never get adequate disease control. So this is a 67-year-old male who's diagnosed with advanced stage follicular lymphoma in 2005, and it was initially treated with RCVP and achieved a complete response that was durable. It was beyond that two-year cutoff that we think of as being important right now in follicular lymphoma. In 2011, he had recurrent adenopathy and underwent a biopsy, which I generally will always advocate for because you never do know if you're still dealing with follicular lymphoma or something else, and again, had relapsed follicular lymphoma. So he initiated R-CHOP, and this is a gentleman who did have some comorbid conditions, including underlying hypertension, hyperlipidemia, cardiovascular disease, and he didn't tolerate R-CHOP very well. He did achieve a partial response, but we ultimately decided to stop after 4 cycles, and he went on to receive maintenance rituximab.
Just a real quick interjection. When you say he didn't tolerate the R-CHOP, in what way?
So he had significant fatigue, cytopenias. He was having trouble staying on schedule, one episode of neutropenic fever. And so I just felt we probably weren't going to get him through the full 6 cycles without a major event.
So what was next?
So he was in the midst of maintenance rituximab because we had had a pretty decent partial response, thinking that maybe we could convert that partial response to a complete response. And he had several months of benefit, but then progressed. So this wasn't a refractory to rituximab situation where it just didn't change. He actually did progress. And so at that point, again, another biopsy was pursued, and he still had persistent follicular lymphoma. It was not a transformation. We intensified therapy, given that he was now failing more intensive therapies, and ultimately he went on to receive RICE with progression. At this point, we switched course and decided to try a PI3 kinase inhibitor, something that was not considered chemotherapy. He actually did quite well and had a very nice partial response that lasted for at least 18 months. But in the midst of therapy, he again progressed.
Could I just ask you before you go on, how did he tolerate the alpelisib?
It's a great question. So he had the sort of what I think of as the typical experience. He did well. The first 6 weeks, we had a little bit of transaminitis, not anything major. We were able to treat through it, and it improved. He's never had any issues with pneumonitis, but he did have an episode of colitis around month 6, which we've gotten very good about training our staff that if you have early onset diarrhea, which we generally think of as in the first 3 months, it's mild, we generally will treat them with supportive care. When we have that late onset diarrhea, which is beyond 6 months of therapy, generally the first thing we do is stop drug. So we stopped drug in his case. After 2 weeks, it resolved. I did dose reduce him down to 100 milligrams twice a day, and he didn't have recurrence of colitis.
So you didn't use corticosteroids?
We didn't have to in that case because we caught it early. Generally speaking, what I generally do is with the first onset of that late diarrhea, again, beyond the first 6 months of therapy, I stop drug immediately when patients call us with diarrhea. And I think you can avoid the corticosteroids. If you ever have a patient that's having more than 6 bowel movements a day, those are the folks that we generally put on steroids, and we give very large doses initially, so generally about a mg per kg until the diarrhea resolves, and then we have them on a sort of a prolonged taper over several weeks.
But the incidence of this delayed colitis, if you had to, you know, sort of approximate a number, it's not most patients, right?
That is correct. Yeah. So the incidence of diarrhea is right around 13-15%. The grade 3-4 diarrhea is right around 3%. So it's very infrequent. I think the problem is it's not identified because these are patients that are sort of cruising along. They're responding. You're not seeing them quite as regularly. So there have been issues with idelalisib recently in terms of their phase 3 studies where they've had higher events on the arm with idelalisib than the placebo. So those studies have been put on hold, and there's been a letter sent out to investigators and physicians describing some of the toxicity associated with idelalisib. In my opinion, I think a lot of it can be minimized if you identify those side effects early and stop the drug. I think what gets people into trouble is when they come in and they have a little bit of a cough and we don't identify it right away, or maybe we put them on steroids and they're on long courses of steroids and they get a super infection. So the Seattle group has identified some, I think, very helpful findings. If the pulse ox drops by more than 5% in the setting of idelalisib, you want to hold drug and think about pneumonitis. I think if you ever have a patient that calls with diarrhea beyond 6 months of therapy, you want to hold drug and monitor them very closely. The other thing that's come out is they probably should be prophylaxed for PCP, and CMV should be monitored regularly, and these patients should be seen more regularly. So I think this is one of those situations where the toxicity, though infrequent, can be serious if it's not identified and managed appropriately.
Any correlation between the presence of these, I guess they're immune-related toxicities, and treatment benefit? I mean, this man did really well, 18-month response.
Yeah, I think that's a great question that we'd all like the answer to. Anecdotally, I have not seen a higher relationship if we have the typical immune-mediated side effects, but they're also infrequent. So it's hard to really get a handle on, is that a predictor of response? We still are struggling a little bit with what is mediating these side effects. Is it truly T-cell mediated, or is it a class effect that we haven't exactly teased out? In my mind, they do appear to be immune-mediated, and we do think that they're probably an impact of the drug on T-cells. And it does appear that in patients that are less heavily pretreated, particularly in the frontline setting, or if you've had a patient that's just had one prior line of therapy, I do worry about those patients more in terms of toxicity than someone who's heavily pretreated, say, 3 or 4 lines of prior therapy. So I still think that it is immune-mediated, and I haven't, in my practice, teased out, does that predict for better response?
How do you integrate idelalisib right now in non-protocol management? Do you add in rituximab, as the label indicates, always? And for a patient who in 2016 follows the more typical route of, let's say, induction BR, where does idelalisib going to fit in?
I think that's a great question that folks are struggling the most with right now. So generally speaking, the patients that I like to use idelalisib are those that are chemo refractory that have not transformed. So usually I want proof that they've not transformed, meaning I will biopsy the most suspicious lesion just to ensure I'm not missing a transformation. But if they've not transformed and they've failed 2 prior lines of chemotherapy, where I like idelalisib is in the setting in comparison to, say, intensifying chemotherapy. So using it instead of, say, RICE or RDAP or more intensive therapies, because I've had much more success in that setting. Where I think the field is looking very closely right now is, what do we do with those patients who fail within their first 2 years of therapy? So the early progressors in follicular lymphoma that usually get intensive frontline chemotherapy, they progress early. And again, we don't think that they have transformed. Those are the patients that their median outcome is approximately 5 years versus the others that do quite well. What we don't know is how to identify those folks before they get to that point, or should we manage them differently? But I generally think that those are patients, if I can't get them on a clinical trial, I'm going to head down the path of, say, something like idelalisib or an immune therapy approach, because I do not think that we're going to get adequate response with more intensive chemotherapy. But that is an unanswered question.
And then again, usually R with it?
So I generally don't give rituximab with idelalisib in the setting of relapsed follicular lymphoma. I will do it in the setting of relapsed CLL.
So in a patient who starts out first line with BR and relapses, how do you think through second line therapy?
That's a great question. So I generally will consider, what was that duration of response? So if I have someone who has several years benefit out of frontline chemoimmunotherapy, and I also take into consideration, how much disease are we dealing with? If they're still of low tumor burden at that first progression, I will observe those patients, because I have had plenty of patients that have this waxing and waning small volume adenopathy that goes on for years. However, once they get to high tumor burden, if they've had a short remission duration, those are the folks I'm trying really hard to get them on trial, or maybe head down the path that is not chemotherapy based. If I have a patient who has a very long first line remission, I'm generally not someone who will re-challenge with bendamustine and say obinutuzumab or rituximab. I don't think that's wrong, but I generally also have more therapies at our center in terms of either clinical trials or other options. So I will use an alternative chemotherapy that they've not had before. If there's any concern that they're heading towards the path of transformation, I might use R-CHOP in that setting. We've explored lenalidomide in the setting of relapsed follicular lymphoma, and that also appears to be quite promising in combination with rituximab, where rather than targeting the B-cell receptor signaling pathway, we're actually augmenting the microenvironment, and we've had some successes with that approach as well.
So this man, after having had this 18-month response on adalimumab, had persistent or relapsed disease. What happened next?
Right. So this is a patient that I applied the Gadolin study, and that he essentially had had refractory disease to rituximab since he had progressed in the setting of maintenance rituximab. He had not had bendamustine before, and so we opted to give him obinutuzumab and bendamustine. He's had a very nice response in the first 6 months of therapy. So right now the question is, how durable will this be?
How did he tolerate the obinutuzumab exactly in terms of infusion reaction?
So he did have an infusion reaction. It had been several years since he had had rituximab, but it's not uncommon for us to see infusion reactions with obinutuzumab. It was manageable. He's had neutropenia, but not anything that's resulted in neutropenic fever. He's had cytopenias in regards to thrombocytopenia and anemia, nothing that's required transfusion. So he's done better with this approach. I've also been gentler, meaning I started at 72 milligrams per meter squared with the bendamustine rather than a higher dose such as 90, and he's done quite well.
I know you and your colleague Nathan Fowler have had a lot of really great studies and publications in follicular lymphoma that relate to a lot of these issues we've been talking about. I just sort of want to ask you about a few of them.
Sure.
First, just in general, where does R-squared stand with follicular lymphoma? Everybody's waiting for the big upfront study. What's the design of that trial, and when do you think we might see some answers?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, again, we think that the microenvironment follicular lymphoma is crucially important. And if you can augment that, you can have improved efficacy. And so that was the whole notion behind lenalidomide rituximab. Can you enhance the NK cells, the T cells, direct them at the follicular lymphoma cells? And based on our phase two studies, the response rates were quite high. Complete response rate was over 85%, and it appeared to be durable. And there was a multi-center study that showed very similar results. There's a lot of heterogeneity in terms of the dosing strategies with lenalidomide and rituximab in terms of how many times you dose with rituximab, what is the duration of therapy, and there's also some differences in the baseline characteristics in that a third of our patients in our phase two study were technically of low tumor burden and may have been suited for observation. So the relevant study was a large international multicenter phase three study where to be eligible, all patients had to have been of high tumor burden, generally based on the GELF criteria. So these are patients that you typically think of needing chemoimmunotherapy in the frontline setting. And so it was a head-to-head comparison of either R-CHOP, BR, or RCVP versus lenalidomide and rituximab. And the dosing strategy was essentially more intensive lenalidomide until you achieved a complete response, which was usually assessed around 6 months. And then you could then transition to a maintenance lenalidomide, which was a lower dose, for a duration of 18 months of lenalidomide. And then it was up to 30 months of rituximab therapy, considering 24 months of maintenance like you would do after frontline chemoimmunotherapy. So the primary endpoint is progression-free survival, and as you might imagine, we would expect that to be long. So the study's still ongoing. The enrollment is completed some time ago. We're still waiting to hear the results. If we don't hear the results for some time, that's generally good news in our minds, because that means that the lenalidomide rituximab is probably just as good. It may not be inferior. There are clearly early stopping rules. We haven't heard nothing in terms of efficacy at this point. We still have patients coming in for follow-up routinely, and so I do think that we're all anxiously awaiting the results. But kind of one of the questions you asked earlier, which I think is still a very important question, how do we choose therapy? How do we sequence therapy? Which patients would you prefer to use lenalidomide rituximab in the frontline setting, or would you rather hold that to the relapse setting where they're starting to fail chemotherapy? I think those are clearly unanswered questions. I hope from these large studies we will have correlatives that will help us maybe predict or risk stratify patients better than we currently do, because I think that's what we're lacking right now in follicular lymphoma. We don't know who's going to be that early progressor, who's chemosensitive, who is not.
How about the thought, if the study ends up showing equivalent efficacy, you would choose R-squared because of tolerability?
So that's a great question. So I used to... at least pitched to patients that this was a non-chemotherapy approach. It's going to be well tolerated. So if you look closely, it's not, again, the head-to-head comparison will answer the question which is better tolerated, but lenalidomide and rituximab have pretty high incidence of fatigue, myalgias, fever, and cytopenia. So it's not infrequent to have a grade 3-4 neutropenia. What's striking about it, at least in our experience, is the side effect intensity seems to be greater in the first few months and then tends to stabilize or improve over time. And it's unclear if patients become accustomed to the side effect profile and they don't report it or don't seem to be bothered by it, or if it really does get easier over time. I don't know the answer to that. But the first 2 months with lenalidomide and rituximab, it's not a free lunch. So we have quite a bit of fever. We do see rashes. We do see myalgias. Neutropenia is not infrequent. Fortunately, despite the grade 3-4 neutropenias, we've not seen much in the way of infections. So I do think it's a different safety profile than what we generally see with chemotherapy-based approaches, but it does have side effects and unique side effects that warrant discussing with patients and management. What I don't know is if you have very proliferative tumors or high tumor burden, do you need chemotherapy in that setting versus lenalidomide and rituximab? We generally do see slower time to response with the immune therapy approaches than what we generally see with chemotherapy. And so that may be a question that's answered with this frontline study. If you have a patient who comes in and they're very high tumor burden, do you need chemotherapy to stabilize them faster? I don't know the answer to that.
I see that you and Dr. Fowler had a paper on characteristics and management of rash following R-squared. What did you look at and what did you see there?
Yeah, so we wanted to describe our outcome because I've seen quite a few patients that lenalidomide has stopped because of rash. And so what we've learned is rash is not uncommon and it can be grade 3, meaning large amount of the body surface area is impacted. It's usually a very red, sometimes pruritic rash. And what's most striking about it is if you stop the drug, almost always you will have the rash go away. And so we just wanted to be able to reassure community doctors that rash is not uncommon. It's striking. It can be full body. It can be uncomfortable. But generally speaking, if you stop the drug, things will get better. Now, you can clearly do antihistamines and short course of low-dose steroids if you want to make that rash go away faster. But generally speaking, we're not altering therapy because of rash most of the time. It really is something that can be managed with a drug holiday and rechallenge with drug. That's the other aspect of that story, is you can successfully rechallenge these patients even who've had grade 3 rash.
This concludes our program. And if you'd like to have a case from your practice presented to one of our program faculty, please email me your case at drneillove@researchtopractice.com. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Hematologic Oncology Update.